33 years. He spent about 1,300 days in his personal ministry the last 3.5 years that he was here. And of those 1,300 days, we have a record of about 50 specific days where events occurred that are recorded for all of history and time. And this morning we want to look at just one day in the life of Jesus. Maybe you had a very busy day this last week and you got up early and a lot of things happened, and maybe memorable things, perhaps just important things that you were able to check off of a list that you needed to get done that were accomplished. I don't know if Jesus kept a to-do list. It seems that many of the things that he did happened to him instead of him happening to them. That is, he had his responsibilities he came to do, but he also took time for people who needed him, who came to him throughout any given day. And that's what we have a record of more in Matthew chapter 9. This centers primarily on his miracles, and we're going to see him helping different kinds of people, different circumstances, but all of them to the glory of God. So let's look in Matthew 9 beginning, and he entered into a ship and passed over and came into his own city. He had been in the land of the Gergesenes or Gadarenes, where he had cast out the demons of two men, one mentioned by Matthew. And then the people of that city asked him to leave. They did not want him in their coast anymore, so he did as they said and got back in the boat, went back across the Sea of Galilee. When he arrived at the seashore city of Capernaum, where he had his headquarters for most of his personal ministry, that city welcomed him. It's called his own city. Chapter 4, verse 13 identifies that as Capernaum. Verse 2, "And behold, they brought unto him a man sick of the palsy, lying on a bed." So he doesn't even get into the city yet. Maybe he's near the city gate, a city street, but he hasn't gotten to the house or the place where he usually stays. And already people know of his reputation. And they bring to him a man that has the palsy, King James has. That's a kind of paralysis. I looked this up and there were 5 different variations of it. We're going to see in Matthew chapter 8 a little later that Jesus healed a servant of a Gentile centurion who also had the palsy. And perhaps his was a different variety from the little indicators that we have in what's said. But these are the 5 different manifestations of palsy. Number 1, a paralysis of the entire body. It was a gradual onset, maybe something like Parkinson's disease, along those lines, that would begin and then steadily get worse and then would end a life prematurely. A second manifestation was only one side of the body would be paralyzed. That was the most common form. So maybe much like a stroke might do today, would left side not be able to use it, or right side. The third manifestation was from the neck down. Maybe we think of something like a car accident causing that. Number 4, a form called catalepsy, which was a contraction of the muscles, and it would come on suddenly. If your hand was outstretched when it came on, you wouldn't be able to bring it in. It would stay in that position. Or if it were at your side, then you wouldn't be able to raise it. It's just locked in that position. And some think that the withered hand that Jesus healed in Matthew 12, 10 to 13 is this catalepsy. Because what would happen after it locked, it would gradually diminish in size and it would dry up and it would wither. And so it wouldn't just have to be an arm, it could be another part of the body, but in that case it was a withered hand. And then the 5th form is cramps, where the limbs are also immovable, and it's a very torturous experience where a person was in constant dreaded pain and then would die within a few days of this. And that may be the kind that the centurion servant had in Matthew chapter 8, because it says that he was grievously tormented. And it doesn't say that about this man, probably a different variety of it. And maybe that's also why the centurion in Matthew 8 was in such a rush to get Jesus to come and help him, because he felt for his condition, also because he would not last too long in that condition. So here's a man who is sick of the palsy. Palsy could therefore go from either something that gradually took away the feeling of the body to something that excited tremendous pain within the body. One would be long-term and the other would be short-term. And behold, they brought unto him a man sick of the palsy, lying on a bed. And Jesus, seeing their faith, said unto the sick of the palsy, Son, be of good cheer, thy sins be forgiven thee. Let's turn over and look at the parallel account in Mark chapter 2. Mark goes into more detail than Matthew does, and we find out how who these men are, they that brought him. Matthew does not identify their number or anything about them, but Mark does. And again, he entered into Capernaum, Mark 2, verse 1, after some days, and it was noised that he was in the house. And straightway many were gathered together, insomuch that there was no room to receive them, no, not so much as about the door, and he preached the word unto them. And that's what Jesus came to do, to reveal the will of God to men. He would preach in the streets, preach on the mountainside, preach in a house, wherever there were people who would gather to hear him preach. On this occasion, maybe you can picture the scene. It may be that he was in Peter's house. Peter had a house in Capernaum. It could have been somebody else's house. But there's such a large number of people that have come inside and taken all the available seats. Maybe they're also sitting on the floor. They're in the doors and the windows, if there are windows, and they're all trying to hear Jesus, get a glimpse of him. There's a crowd outside, so that here come these men who've heard that Jesus is here. They are determined that their friend is going to be healed by Jesus, but they get there and they cannot get through the crowd. There are too many people in the way. Let's read about that. And they come unto him, verse 3, bringing one sick of the palsy, which was borne or carried afore. We don't know these men's names. We don't know the man with the palsy's name. But these are unnamed heroes of a sort. What remarkable friends this man had, and how blessed he was to have these friends. They could have brought him and said, well, we'll just have to come back another day. It looks like Jesus is busy today. Or we just can't get through this crowd. I don't know what we can do. Well, maybe we'll try again later. But they were not of that variety. They were determined that Jesus was going to heal their friend this day. And so they came up with the idea they would go up on the roof. Now, they don't receive as much rainfall in that part of the world as we do, and so the roofs are generally flat or nearly so. And they also, at least in the cities, did not have a lot of property, or it was too expensive for a person to afford, so they would have a house that was small and built on a small plot of land, and very close to it would be another house built. They used their roofs as porches, what we would do, use as a porch, a place to relax or meditate upon the Word of God or even rest. So there are people would go up on the roofs, and there was a law in the Old Testament, maybe Deuteronomy 22:8. Maybe that's not the verse, that's just off the top of my head, but there's a verse that says you had to build a rail around your roof so that if somebody was up there, they couldn't fall off easily and be killed or injured. But if it was beside someone else's house, they would build a short rail instead that could be stepped over, and the houses were so close together they could walk from one to another and then walk down at the end of the row or the street, down to the street. And many of the houses had exterior steps so that one did not have to go through the house to go up on the roof. They could just go up and down on the outside of the house. That's probably what you have here. They see those steps going up the side of the building of the house, and they say, well, let's go up there. Sometimes they would have an opening in the roof, and they'd also have to build a rail around this that looked down into a courtyard or into the interior of the house. And maybe they thought, well, if we get up there, there may be a way we can get Jesus to see him. They get up there, but evidently there was no hole in the roof. There was no place where they could go down into the house from there. So then they surely could have given up. You know, well, we, We try, but I don't know what we can do now. There's no way down there, and Jesus is busy. And one of them must have said, you know, what if... I wonder how thick this roof is. They built their roofs a little differently than we do, of course. They did have sort of like our rafters, boards that were so many feet apart for the support of it. But then they would put brushwood, something like thatch, but a little bit more sturdy than that. And then on top of that, they would put clay or sometimes tile. Didn't get a lot of rain anyway over there, so it wasn't the same need to waterproof it, at least not to the degree that we do. And so Mark's account actually uses a word that means dug through. So maybe it was clay that they had here, or they broke the tiles up. But anyway, they decided they would just dig through the roof. Jesus is right down there if we could just get to him. Well, I'm wondering. And so they began to break up the roof. Have you wondered whose house this was? It wasn't their house. They were strangers there. Who's going to pay for this? What's he going to think? Their love for their friend caused them to determine, we're not giving up. We're going to see that our friend is healed this day. Now, there are some lessons to be learned, I think, from that before we see the rest of the miracle. One is, it's a blessing to have a friend like that. It's a blessing to be a friend like that. He that hath friends must show himself friendly. Proverbs 18:24. Am I that kind of friend? That's willing to be put out and to go to a second mile and to help someone who is in need. And here's another lesson. Blessed is the sinner who has a friend who will go to as much trouble to save his or her soul as these men would go to save their friend's body. I've seen that a few times. As a gospel preacher, I've seen a lot of people who've brought family members and friends and acquaintances to the Lord, but a few times under such extraordinary circumstances that they just refused to give up. There were reasons to give up. They were told to go away. The circumstances were not at all conducive, but they were so prayerful, so persistent, that eventually their love won that soul. And blessed is the sinner who has a Christian friend or family member like these four who refused to give up. Now, let's move back into this story, verse 4. And when they could not come nigh to him for the press, they uncovered the roof where he was. That word uncovered means to dig through. And when they had broken it up, could be the tiles, they let down the bed wherein the sick of the palsy lay. Let's change the perspective. We've been up on the roof with the friends and the man with the palsy. Let's go down into the house with Jesus and the crowd of people. Jesus is preaching. People are listening. This is a serious occasion. This is what he came to do. And maybe they hear the noise up on the roof first. There's some banging up there. And if Jesus was like most preachers, he might have just got a little louder, a little more animated, and just kept going. You know, we try to out-preach our distractions whenever they happen. But then there's dust that starts coming down and dirt falling on people. And then there's light coming through, sunlight through the... Well, at this point, I suppose Jesus stopped preaching. Most of us would have stopped at this point and looked up. What did Jesus say when he looked up? What did Jesus see when he looked up? He saw these four men who loved their friend. And then he looked down, once they lowered their friend down, and he saw a man with a diseased body and a sinful soul who needed his help. And then he looked around, and let's see that. When Jesus saw their faith, that's looking up, he said unto the sick of the palsy, now he's looking down, son, thy sins be forgiven thee. But there were certain of the scribes sitting there and reasoning in their hearts. So he looks around at the crowd. Evidently, these scribes who had gotten there early enough to get a front row seat, they weren't on the outside at the windows peering in. They had gotten there and they were inside the room with Jesus, and he looks at them. And instead of seeing men who were smiling because this man has received the attention of Jesus, has been forgiven by Jesus, instead he sees scowl on their face, critical looks. And then he looks within their hearts and he reads what they're thinking. Verse 7, why doth this man thus speak blasphemies? Who can forgive sins but God only? Now what they say is true enough. If you said to me or I said to you, your sins be forgiven you, we don't have that prerogative. We do not have that power. How could we, how could a man forgive another man's sins in the gross or the corporate sense, the large sense? We can't do that. We can forgive someone if they sin against us, but we can't absolve them of the consequences of their sins over a lifetime, as Jesus says here. But Jesus was no mere man, and that was the point. He's now drawn the line. Either he has divine prerogative to forgive sins, and thus he is the Son of God, or he is an imposter and is to be rejected. That line has been drawn. The scribes reason on the one side that he's a mere man taking liberties with God's name that do not belong to him. And immediately when Jesus perceived in his spirit that they so reasoned within themselves, he said unto them, why reason ye thus these things in your hearts? Let's flip back over to Matthew now. The same thing is recorded in Matthew. And I'd rather read it over here with you so you can make a note. We've been making notes in Matthew, so if you want to make a note, then this would be a good place to make it. You can make the same note in Mark later if you want. We're in verse 4 now. Wherefore think ye evil in your hearts? For whether it is easier to say, I'm in Matthew 8, verse 5, thy sins be forgiven thee, or to say, arise and walk. Jesus says, it's six one way and half a dozen another. Which it's not any harder or easier or harder for me to say, thy sins be forgiven thee, or to say, take up your bed and walk. Now he reveals the purpose of his miracles in verse 6. And that's the notes you might want to write beside or under that verse if you can. Purpose of miracles. And I've written also CF 13, 10 to 15. But you might not have room to write that unless you write really small. But write purpose of miracles. And the parallel verse is chapter 13, 10 through 15. But let's read this. But what say... But that ye may know that the Son of Man hath power, the word means authority, on earth to forgive sins. Then saith he to the sick of the palsy, arise, take up thy bed, and go into thine house. Now the bed here is not a bed like we would sleep on, not a hospital bed. It's more like a pallet, a thick rug or a blanket. And they were able to take each man on the corner and to carry him. And then they carried him up those steps. Somehow they got him on the roof, probably by exterior steps. It broke through the roof. That'd be a pretty big hole because you couldn't stand him up on that or he'd just fall, you know. So they had to make a hole big enough for a man to be let down and each one to have a corner. And they had a rope around it somehow. And they lowered him down. He's on the ground. They're up there. And Jesus says, arise, take up your bed that they brought you here on, that it's been your prison, in a manner of speaking, for all this time that you've had this disease. Take it up and walk. Go home. So he did two things he would not have been able to do the day before, walk and carry his bed. And he arose and departed to his house. Man with paralysis walked. The man who had no control of his body was able to carry his bed. So there's the lesson. This man had two things working for him, the faith of his friends and the favor of the friend of sinners. Another idea here before we move on is whenever a person wants to come to Jesus, there's often a crowd between Jesus and that person. In fact, Burton Kaufman says in his comments on this passage that the devil will position a crowd of people between you and the Lord. But we've got to go around them. We've got to go through them. We've got to value the opinion of Jesus and of God more than we value the friends of our parents, if they're the ones who stand between us and obedience to Christ, or our spouse, our children, our friends. Whoever it is that's trying to keep me from being who Jesus wants me to be is a barrier that I need to get around, because nothing is more important than getting to Jesus. Nothing is more important than receiving the blessing of salvation that only Jesus can give. And people can laugh us into hell, but they cannot laugh us into heaven. They can make fun of us and bully us and dominate us away from God, but they won't do that toward God. But you and I can make that decision as creatures made in God's image with power of volition. We can make up our minds that we will do what God wants us to do regardless of what men may say or regardless of what the crowd, the majority, may think. We are independent. We are autonomous. We're going to stand in judgment, be judged individually. Therefore, we are wise to make our decisions in view of that individually. Well, let's move on and talk about it in Matthew chapter 9. The next section that we'll just notice is that Jesus calls Matthew in verse 9, who was a publican. There was a tax collecting center in Capernaum. Matthew seems to have been one of the workers there. Follow me, and he does. And then there's a discussion about the physician and the sinners, those that are whole need not a physician. But let's drop down to verse 18 as we see this next section that deals with Jesus' miracles. We've seen four friends and a crippled man, Matthew 4, 2 through 8. Now let's observe a synagogue ruler and his daughter. Verse 18, when he spake these things unto them, behold, there came a certain ruler and worshipped him, saying, my daughter is even now dead. Very few parents ever have to say that. That's the reverse process. All of us eventually have to say, my father has died, my mother has died. But it's unusual in the course of things for the parent to say, my daughter has died. My son has died. Now, some in this room have experienced that great blow, but most haven't, and those who haven't never wish to. That's a horrible thing to contemplate. But this man faced it. I think it's interesting first to observe that he was a ruler of the synagogue. In John 7:48, when Jesus was being opposed by his enemies, those from the elite crowd said, have any of the rulers or of the Pharisees believed on him? Well, yes, as a matter of fact, one of them has. The synagogue ruler over in Capernaum, he's a believer. He came to Jesus, not demanding, but he came humbly. You see it in Matthew, he comes and worshiped him, Matthew says. You see it in the parallel Mark 5, 22 and 23, which says that he fell down. I mean, here's the man, he's one of the suit-wearing people. I mean, he's one of the upper class. He's one of the men in this city that would have been respected in any circle. And he comes and falls down at Jesus' feet and says, now, it's also his humility is also seen in that he came himself and he did not send somebody. I mean, if your daughter had just died, would you get up and leave? Wouldn't you stay with the family? Wouldn't you stay with her body? Wouldn't you be there in the center of this storm? But he says, I got to go. And he gets out of the house, down the street, finds where Jesus is, falls down, says, you got to come with me. My daughter has died. Now, in the other accounts, in Mark's account, for instance, when he left the house, it seems that she had not died yet, but she was on the brink of it. He gets there, and then someone comes and makes a report. Don't bother the master anymore. She's died. And Jesus quickly says to him, comforts him, says, I'll go with you. Now, I want to skip ahead. Let me read just a little bit here and then we'll skip some. But come and lay thy hand on her and she shall live. So he's humble and he's full of faith. I mean, you don't go get a doctor when a death has occurred, right? That's when you get the mortician. What good does it do to administer medicine post-mortem? It doesn't do any good. But this man had faith that the great physician was not limited by death. The one who would be the resurrection and the life, who would come out of his own grave, surely he could do something in this case. Now, Jesus raised three people from the dead while he was on earth. This might have been the first one. It certainly was the first one in Capernaum. He raised Lazarus, but that was later, John chapter 11, so that hasn't occurred yet. The widow of Nain's son in Luke 7:11-14 could have been before this, but that was in another city, in Nain, outside of Nain. And maybe he had heard about that, maybe he hadn't, but he had great faith. He had never seen Jesus raise the dead, but he thought, he can do this. And so he comes and he makes that request. So he has great faith and he has great humility. And so he follows, goes to the house. We're going to skip and come back, but skip down with me to verse 23. And when Jesus came into the ruler's house and saw the minstrels and the people making a noise, their culture, their tradition was whenever a death takes place, they would bring in musicians and they would play sad, wailing, sad music, and there would be wailing, singing. It was just a tumult. And Jesus is like, get them out of here. She's not dead. She's asleep. And, well, he meant the effect of it is as if she's asleep, because I'm going to wake her up. I'm going to bring her back. But they all laughed at him. They laughed him to scorn, verse 24 says, the last part. Had you ever thought about this? If sinners laugh at you, they laughed at Jesus first. What do we have to go through that He did not go through? What do we have to go through for Him that He did not first go through for us? And usually worse than we have to face, such as being whipped and crucified. But in this case, He knows what it's like to be laughed at. We may have to be laughed at. But that also is a proof that she really was dead. I mean, her parents say she's dead. The people that were attending her say she's dead, have made that report to him. Those who've come for the funeral say she's dead and laugh at Jesus for saying she's not. So all that is in evidence that Jesus is raising the dead and not just healing the sick here. And of course, the testimony of the inspired Word of God confirms that. Then verse 25, but when the people were put forth, He went in and took her by the hand. Now, the parallel account says that the mother and father and the inner circle, Peter, James, and John, got to go in too. So there's six men, six adults, and the girl in the room where this girl is. And he takes her by the hand. Now, a high priest could not touch a dead body, according to Leviticus 21:10-11. But Jesus, even though he would be a high priest, touched her because it did not corrupt him any more than disease was transferred to him by touching a sick person or a diseased person. So he took her by the hand as if he were just going to help her up, wake her up. He raised her up from the dead, no more difficult for him, the one or the other. And when the people were put forth, he went in. Verse 26, the fame thereof went abroad into all that land. Let's move on. Let's talk about a third. A woman with an issue of blood. We're going to go back because we mentioned this is one day in Jesus' life. You picture him preaching in the house, broken roof, heals the man. And then he goes out and he sees Matthew, come be my apostle, and he has this discussion, and then he comes, while he's having this discussion, he's Jairus, the ruler of the synagogue, whom everybody would have known in the Jewish community, comes, falls out on his feet, says, you got to come with me quick. So Jesus says, okay, and he starts. And while he's going, and this great crowd of people that's followed him out of the house and is watching, listening, learning, and others wanting to have miracles. So there's a great crowd of people. And he's going down the street toward wherever it is that Jairus is not named in Matthew, but that is who it is. He's named in Mark. And he goes down the street, and while he's going, a woman comes up behind him. She's in this crowd. We don't know her name. And she just just touches his clothes as he walks by. Now let's read about her a little bit. We may go to Mark on this one too, but let's read a little bit in Matthew, verse 20. And behold, a woman which was diseased with an issue of blood 12 years. So she's been bleeding for 12 years. Came behind him and touched the hem of his garment. Well, let's do a look at Mark. Go over with me to Mark 5. See 26, maybe 25 and 26. Because we have more details in Mark than we do in Matthew. Matthew's purpose is more theological than miraculous. The emphasis in Matthew is more on what Jesus said. But he uses the miracles as illustrations in these to make his points. Mark is more on Jesus, the Son of God, the miracle worker. And so there's more emphasis on the details. So here Matthew, Mark chapter 5, beginning in 25. And a certain woman had an issue of blood 12 years and had suffered many things of many physicians. She had spent a lot of time in waiting rooms at doctor's offices, you think? And had spent all that she had. Some things don't change a lot, do they? She's been to a lot of doctors and they've charged her money for their services and she's run out of money. But she's not any better. But rather grew worse. You know, a lot of conditions are that way. They start out and they gradually become more chronic and worse. When she heard of Jesus, came in the press behind and touched his garment. For she said... Now, wait a minute, let me, before I read this, think about if you were her. Women did not speak publicly much in that culture at all, anyway. We'll talk about that a little bit more in the sermon today. And she was, she had a condition. I mean, other people came up and said, I'm blind, would you heal me? Or I'm, well, they wouldn't say it if they were deaf, but they would indicate it. Or, you know, I've got a withered hand, a palsy. Whatever it was, they would speak out loud. This is my condition. I need help. Can you imagine being her and coming up and saying, Jesus, I've got... She didn't want to say that out loud. In public, to a man. So, I could see this reason in her mind. You know, maybe I wouldn't have to say it. Maybe she said, I could just tell him I'm sick and he would know. Or maybe she's, no, I don't even need to. What if I could just, instead of him touching me, what if I just touched him? And then she said, you know, I think it might work if I just, now, there's no precedent for this. There's nowhere in the Bible where, or nowhere it says that Jesus healed by his clothes. But somehow she got it in her mind. Maybe she was thinking about the Psalm 133:2, which says that when the priest was anointed, the oil would go down on his clothes. And maybe that she was reading that one day and she thought, you know, maybe his clothes. He's a prophet, they're anointed too. Anyway, she came to her conclusion that if she just touched the hem of his garment. Now the hem is not like our hems, it was the tassels. Deuteronomy 22:12, Jews wore tassels on their clothes to remind them of their relationship to God. And so she thought, if I just touch the tassels. And she did. And it worked. She felt in her body that she was made whole. And she's just going to fade back into the crowd and go home and live happily ever after. She is healed. But let's read this. Jesus won't let her do that. If I may but touch his clothes, Mark 5:28, I shall be whole. And straightway the fountain of her blood was dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of that plague. And Jesus, immediately knowing in himself that virtue had gone out of him, gives us an indication of what healed people, doesn't it? Virtue. Turned him about in the press and said, who touched my clothes? Now, the disciples think this is silly for him to ask this question. I like the relationship between Jesus and his disciples. It wasn't so much of a yes, sir, you know, commander relationship as it was a friend. I mean, you I mean, what soldier would say what they're about to say to their commanding general? They would just nod and whatever he says, go, you know? But that's not the way Jesus interacted with his disciples. And Jesus immediately, verse 31, disciples said, "Thou seest the multitude thronging thee, and sayest thou, who touched me?" What are you talking about? Everybody touched you, Jesus. There's a huge crowd of people. And everybody's jostling, bumping into each other. And a bunch of people touched you. And he looked around about to see her. He didn't really need to know, you know, who touched me. He knew to see her that had done this thing. And the woman, fearing and trembling, can you imagine? The roller coaster of emotions in her heart, the despair, and then the joy, and now the, oh boy, I'm caught. Or everybody's looking at me, you know, the birthday song moment, you know, everybody's looking at you in the crowd, trembling and astonished, or fearing and trembling, knowing what was done, her came and fell down before him and told him all the truth. Isn't that interesting, just as an aside, that two people in Capernaum that had nothing in common both met at Jesus' feet? I mean, this woman and Jairus, they probably had never met before. I mean, they ran in different circles. He was, you know, he was important. She was not. He was a man. She was a woman. He was a ruler of the synagogue, and her condition would not even let her go to the synagogue services. Leviticus 25:15. He had a name, Jairus, and she was anonymous. He had a daughter who had been well for 12 years and had died. She had a condition. She had had a condition for 12 years, and she got better. I mean, they're opposite. Can you imagine that? The same length of time when Jairus' wife had the baby 12 years ago. This woman first noticed her condition. The little girl had been growing up, many happy moments. This lady had been going to doctors, fretting about her condition. But on the same day, the daughter died and was raised, and this woman came to Jesus and was healed. Isn't that remarkable? She told him all the truth. And he said unto her, "Daughter, thy faith hath made thee whole. Go in peace and be whole of the plague." There are two reasons, no doubt, that Jesus called her out, if we might speculate about it. One is to reward her faith, as he compliments her faith here. I mean, she had great faith, and that deserved to be recognized, and he did. And also, so that the world would have it as a record. If she had just touched him and gone, you and I wouldn't be talking about this. And how much do we enjoy and learn from and benefit from reading about her faith and what happened to her? And so Jesus, and of all the miracles that Jesus did, this one made the cut. You know, this one made it into the Bible because it was a unique one and had special lessons to teach. All right, let's move back into Matthew chapter 9 as our time's rapidly getting away from us. I do picture, while you're turning back, Jairus, and this woman is, you know, touched him, and Jesus has stopped, and the crowd, and all this is going on. I can picture Jairus over there. I mean, can you? Come on. We gotta. You know, his daughter was dead. We gotta get over there and take care of this. And he's stopping for somebody else. But Jesus, in this day, saw her need and helped her, knowing he would also be able to help Jairus. Well, that brings us next down to the two blind men in verse 27. I read that Jesus healed six different blind people while he was on earth. These are two of them. And when Jesus departed thence, so he's left the house of Jairus now. And maybe he's going back to the house that has the hole in the roof to go back to preaching a sermon again. And two blind men followed him, I guess, down the street. I don't know how they did this. Maybe somebody was helping them. Maybe they were very familiar with the street and were able to go of their own accord. But as they follow him, they're crying and saying, "Thou son of David," that's a messianic term. Matthew 1, verse 1. Old Testament, Psalm 72, 12 and 13, for instance, a lot of places. The son of David was a prophecy of the Messiah. And when they identify Jesus of Nazareth as the son of David, they are saying, we believe you are the Messiah. We believe you are the Son of God. Now here these blind men were able to see something that those scribes we talked about earlier couldn't see with their good eyesight. Here is something that these men are willing to own publicly in a street in Capernaum that the Pharisees would only deny in the temple in Jerusalem. And even some of the rulers who believed on him would not confess him because they feared being put out of the synagogue. But these were willing to confess him. But Jesus ignores them, at least to start with. And when he was coming to the house, so all the way down the street, they've been following him and they've been crying out to him. But Jesus hasn't said anything to them yet. But they go, they're persistent. They go right into the house with him. And Jesus saith unto them, believe ye that I am able to do this? They said to him, yea, Lord, no doubt, we know you can do it. Then touched he their eyes, saying, according to your faith, be it unto you. And their eyes were opened. And Jesus straightly charged them, saying, see that no man know it. That's probably why he didn't do it out on the street. Because he gave the stipulation, as he sometimes did, don't tell anybody. If he'd done it out on the street, there was public knowledge. I wrote down, I think it's four or five reasons. These are interesting to me. Why Jesus might want to keep this miracle private. One, to show his followers an example of humility. You know, when we do good works, it's not for other people to see it. It's to glorify God. That's a perfect example of that. Let not the right hand know what the left hand does. Matthew 6:3. Number two, to show displeasure to the city of Capernaum. They had already had so many miracles and they were still rejecting him. Not cast any more pearls before swine, as it were. Three, to show discretion, because every time he did a miracle, the jealousy of the Jews went up and they wanted to arrest him and kill him. And so he had work to do before that occurred. Number four, and lastly, to keep people from wanting to make him a king on earth, as they did at least on one other occasion, John 6, verse 15. All right, I know our time is up, so I'll just mention the demon-possessed man, the last miracle that Jesus did, Matthew 9, 32 to 38. And this demon caused this poor man not to be able to communicate with others, but Jesus cast out the demon and he was able to speak. That's a background of what we'll study in our sermon a little while from now. We'll look at Matthew chapters 8 and 9 and the 10 miracles that Jesus did. But we won't be able to go into the same detail, so I wanted to do that with you in this class. Let's be dismissed then until the worship hour.